I am Conor MacLeod of the Clan MacLeod, and I am immortal.
Looking for a dead guy named Nash.
You talk funny, Nash. Where are you from?
Lots of different places.
I am Juan Sanchez Villalobos Ramirez, chief metallurgist to King Charles V of Spain.
Well, everybody's got their problems.
You're alive. Why didn't you die?
Hey, it's a kind of magic.
Hi, I'm Candy.
Of course you are.
Hello, and welcome to Another Time MacLeod, the only podcast, to our knowledge, dedicated to breaking down and analysing the 1986 cult classic Highlander. I'm your host, Rob Wallace, and as always, I'm joined by my kinsman, Mr. Rob Daniel.
And as always, it's a pleasure to be here.
And we are flying solo today. Hopefully that hasn't prompted anybody to just go, oh, okay, done. How many are you flying solo for? Can you let us know now?
Yeah, that's right. Maybe you should put that into the episode title or into the show notes at least. It's been a while since we've been flying solo, hasn't it? It's
the last solo episodes that we did were the ones on the discovery of Fazil's body in the underground garage.
Was it? Wow. That was really early on. What, the first time that we meet Brenda?
Yeah.
What the hell have you got?
A Toledo Salamanca.
A what?
Sword, Frank. A very rare sword.
Wow. Okay. Well, let's see if we can stay on our game without a guest.
Uh-oh. I think we're right. It's like, you know, we've got some experience of doing this. Through a prolonged period of silence. Just a solid minute. I'm just going to put a solid minute in there.
What you need to know about me, though, Rob, is that I just reset to dead zero every single time on this. So it's like I'm doing it for the first time every single time.
They set you to read only when you send out alone.
That's right. That's exactly it.
My CPU is a neural net processor, a learning computer. But Skynet presets the switch to read only when we are sent out alone.
Doesn't want you to do too much thinking, huh?
No.
Can we reset the switch?
We have to do the Terminator next, aren't we?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely, yeah, Terminator 2. Well, today we're going to be talking about the scene between 47 minutes and 12 seconds and 49 minutes and 31 seconds, which I guess can be neatly summarised as just feel the stack.
Let yourself feel the stack.
Yeah, I think that has to be the episode title as well, right? Feel the stag.
Yeah, I mean, feel the stag.
S-C-H-T-A-G.
Yeah.
Actually, S-C-H-T-A-A-A-G. Feel the stag.
Stag. Stag. Okay, well, this scene was shot on the Silver Sands Murrah, which is apparently on the River Murrah feeding into Loch Murrah, which again is up around the kind of Glenfinnan area of Scotland.
And what happens in this scene? What are we talking about today?
Well, in this scene, Connor and Ramirez are on the beach together, and essentially Ramirez has Connor sort of take a moment and sense the stag that's in this distance and, you know, connect with it, feel the blood coursing through its veins.
Now for the last. Trust me. Let yourself feel the stag. His heart beating. His blood coursing. Feel?
And it's basically about the idea of the quickening as... Well, it's not just the lightning that shoots out when you chop someone's head off. It's also a profound sense of oneness and connection with all living beings.
Yeah, which Ian's talked about on previous episodes. So Ian Bird, regular contributor. And in this scene, Ramirez says it's the quickening or something like that.
MacLeod! This is the quickening!
And it's like, okay, right, so this is the quickening, you're right. This is the oneness with the universe, with the supreme empathy of being aware of every single organism. Also does seem to be a little bit blurred in terms of what the actual quickening is sometimes when, because there's a lot of similarities between that and then when someone gets their head chopped off and what happens to the victor afterwards. But yeah, this is the scene in which he seems to be saying the quickening is the profound empathy with everything in the universe, which then obviously is like kind of just a foretaste of what the prize is, right? Because
Exactly. Yes, it's profound connection and empathy with all things. Now go cut that stag's head off.
Yeah, because that's dinner tonight.
It's so this scene opens with that wonderfully framed shot of the beach, which is wonderfully kind of balanced and painterly. And it's, you know, I think a sort of another shout out to Jerry Fisher, who along with Tony Mitchell was a cinematographer on this film. And he also did films like Bridge on the River Kwai. He did The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes' Smarter Brother, which is...
Is that the Gene Wilder one?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, it's quite good, that is. It's a weird, odd film. It's not entirely successful, but it does have some very, very funny moments.
Do you have a brother whose first name is Sherlock?
I do not.
You do have a brother?
I do.
Might I inquire as to his first name?
Yeah, he's got a one. I mean, he did Escape to Victory, which of course...
Oh, that's just one of my all-time favourites. That is a cheese classic, Escape to Victory. If anyone hasn't seen Escape to Victory, the football film... Well, sorry, the World War II prisoner war camp football film starring Michael Caine, Pelé, Sylvester Stallone, and the Ipswich squad. Also, Max von Sydow. Then they have to watch that as soon as possible. There are moments in that film you can cry out without shame. A cheese classic.
As in this one.
Yes.
he also did the cinematography for a film, and this is a shout out to my mate Chris Carr, Dead Bang, that Chris is a big fan of. 1989 film directed by John Frankenheimer, starring Don Johnson, Penelope Ann Miller, William Forsythe, Bob Balaban and Tim Reed.
Which I've never seen, actually. I do need to see that.
Don Johnson is Jerry Beck, LAPD.
You're not a safe man to put on the streets, Mr. Beck.
He doesn't like trouble. He is trouble.
If I get pulled off of this case, you will never feel safe in your world again.
Because I always saw it in the video shop. It had a very... I seem to remember that the cover was kind of reminiscent of the Die Hard poster in that it was half of Don Johnson's face and there was an explosion behind it or something. But heavens, was that always face up in the video shop when I went in there.
But in this case, it's a lovely shot of a beach with the kind of rocks in the foreground covered in that yellow lichen, which apparently is called shore lichen or Xanthoria parietina.
Okay. And what are the specific qualities of that? Or is it just...
It's a yellow lichen that grows on rocks near the shore.
Right. Well, I'm liking the name, so...
And you've got Connor and Ramirez in the distance on the beach, you know, framed by these rocks. And what's really nice is you actually get the crescendo of the score from the previous scene, from the training scene.
Now for the last.
Well, this whole sequence is kind of the end of the training scene, isn't it? And it's... There's a couple of really nice callbacks that we'll talk about in just a second, but... Yeah, this is the end of him training Connor. And what I like about it is that it's not just a montage scene set to a song in which you can see he's getting better at fighting. There's actually a lot of philosophy and spiritualism in this as well. So it's, yeah.
And I now want a training montage where you can see he's getting better at empathy. It's essentially just like, this has just turned into The Good Place.
Aristotle was Plato's student, and Aristotle believes that your character is voluntary because it's just the result of your actions, which are under your control. For example, right now, you have made the insane choice to ignore the person who is literally trying to save you from eternal damnation.
No, yeah, I'm listening. Are we sure we should be paying attention to these guys? It's like, who died and left Aristotle in charge of ethics?
Plato.
No, it's one of those things where every time you see him, he's just crying harder and harder. So at the end, it looks like the end of Airplane. It's just water running down his face. With a big smile on his face, like a beatific smile on his face as he sobs at just how wonderful all the cosmic connections of the universe are.
This isn't actually a beach, this is meant to be inland. He's just...
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Well, you've turned this into a beachfront property. Well, it's going to add value to it. That is some heavy salt water there.
But, I think this is the first time that you kind of see Connery in his costume in mid, and it's him kind of just moving. It's him just walking, and the costume looks like kind of that wonderful red, it's not like satiny, but it feels like there's got a sort of weight and awkwardness to it that you think wouldn't be actually particularly convenient for fighting in.
That's interesting. So this is the first time that we've seen him properly move in his costume, are you saying? Because he's had a few...
Yeah, I mean, I know we've seen some sword fighting scenes, but this is like the first time we've just seen him like try and walk in it.
Okay. Oh, interesting. I didn't actually notice that. It's all the elements about it, the U sword that seemed like actually that would be hard to fight in.
Well, it's those shoulder pads. It's the kind of shoulder pads that is, you know, sort of very, in this case, I guess 1880s, 1780s, but yeah, very sort of 1980s throwback. And it's just, I'd be interested to know, and actually go and do a bit of research, what material that costume was made out of.
Yeah, I wouldn't even know where to start with that. But yes, it's an interesting point that, because it does look... I would look ridiculous in it. And the fact that he wears it so well, I think is also just another example of what a great actor Connery was and also what he could bring to the role. Because it's like, well, he has to convince in this role as the mentor. And he also brings, as we'll talk about in the next episode, he brings a lot of the pathos into this. So he has to convince. You can't have people giggling at him because he looks ridiculous. And yeah, he is wearing a flamboyant costume, but he brings the character to justify the flamboyance.
Also, does he have more than one of those? Because in the same way that Connor seems to only have one kilt, we never see him out of it.
I was thinking about that in terms of previous episodes when you just think, they're always wearing the same clothes. And I suppose that would be something that would happen then. I mean, you wouldn't be able to just have a lot of clothes. Although in the next episode, we are going to hear that Heather has more than one dress. But everything's going to stink. I mean, I would love to go back in time just to have a good smell of everything, because you might find that you just can't stand near anyone because they smell so bad, because they haven't really, they've got one set of kits. No matter how many times you wash it, it's always going to have a musk about it. So it could be that the Ramirez does actually hum a little bit, or he has lots of scented powders and perfumes that he douses himself in every morning in a morning ritual so that he smells fragrant.
I mean, isn't there something to do with the idea that, something to do with obviously rendering animals, you get fat out of it and you can get sort of, that kind of provides the basis of soap. And that at certain point in civilization, we discovered that washing clothes downstream from where they used to kind of render the animals actually made the clothes cleaner, because it was essentially acting like a kind of natural soap.
Yeah, which is the, and there's a reference to that in Fight Club, isn't it? When they talk about when you wash downriver of human sacrifice.
Ancient peoples found their clothes got cleaner when they washed them at a certain point in the river. You know why?
No.
Because human sacrifices were once made on the hills above this river. Bodies burned, water seeped through the wood and ashes to create lye. This is lye, the crucial ingredient. Once it mixed with the melted fat of the bodies, thick white soapy discharge crept into the river.
And yeah, so I mean, it'll be interesting though if that is true or if it's just an apocryphal story that makes sense. But yes, there is, but you're right, it is the fat that was rendered that did actually form soap. So yeah. But even then you think, like, well, that's not going to be, I suppose you could scent the soap even then, but most people I don't think are going to scent the soap. They'll just use it to get the stains out. So yeah.
And that's the thing. I mean, tallow candles used to stink.
Yeah. So
like, it wasn't like one of those lovely fragrant things or clean burning things you light up at the home now, like everything stank.
Yeah. So thinking to go back in time, particularly to this point, to the 16th century, you'd probably spend the first few seconds there just gagging and maybe bringing up your breakfast, because it's like, oh, everything smells so bad. Just the air stinks.
And you'd probably contract quite a few diseases that don't exist anymore.
Yes, we should have got in hazmat suits, because, yeah, there are just so many things in the air that our bodies have just forgotten to be afraid of and to build up an immunity to. Certainly wouldn't be immortal. So anyway, so that was a tangent, wasn't it?
Well, and then obviously you've got the first shot of the stag looking into camera.
Which is an interesting shot of the stag, because as Russell Mulcahy says on the audio commentary, that's a National Geographic shot that they licensed. So it's not actually the stag that you see running. And when you watch it again after knowing that, it's, oh yeah, it does seem to have a different kind of film grain to it. And the stag that they did use, its antlers are glued on because it wasn't the time of year for it to have full-grown antlers. So apparently they were like, yeah, little nubs on its head because they lose their antlers once a year, apparently. So they glued the antlers onto the stag. And I think, so, well, that must have been some pretty good glue because you can't see them wobbling. And I went back and looked at it a couple of times and thought, no, I wouldn't guess that they were glued on.
I can't get the antlers glued to this little guy. We tried crazy glue.
Yes.
I can't get the antlers glued onto this little guy. We tried crazy glue, but it don't work.
Have you tried staples?
You tried staples? every single episode should have a Scrooged reference in it as well. And they lost the stag. It just ran off at one point and they couldn't find it.
Yeah, it's trying to get the fucking antlers off.
Yes, it probably was. It was saying, call my agent, call my agent. I didn't sign up for this. So they spent 2 hours looking for it because it just scarpered. It does seem as if that was just to get that very, very brief moment of the stag. It actually took a lot of work. It took licensing something from the National Geographic archive and also spending a couple of hours looking for this wayward stag, which had run off with the antlers.
Also, like, a scene that is about feeling empathy for this creature is... is simultaneously, in order to the practicalities of filming, you have to feel no empathy with the creature because you've just stuck antlers to its head.
Yeah, I think, yes, but I think that this was monitored by the Humane Association. I think they were probably trying to be careful of its feelings. But yes, it was probably, it might have been like one of those things when...
Feel the stag. How does it feel? Fucking annoyed.
Yes, it's like, as a kid, when you get like a bonnet from your sister's doll and then put it on the cat and say, look at how cute it looks as it runs around trying to go, just trying to get it off with its paw. And then your mum would say, stop annoying the cat. So at some point, Heather here is saying, oh, stop annoying the stag. But the important thing is he does feel empathy for it and he runs very fast. And there's a really nice moment there where he says, come on, haggis, which is a nice callback to earlier in this montage.
MacLeod, come on! I feel him! Come on! I feel it! Come on, haggis!
It's kind of the moment where they become friends.
Yeah, it is. There is an element of that, isn't there? Because he does... Yeah, because he's just so full of joy at that moment. And yes, you're right. It is a nice moment for that.
You know, him and Lord Summer Isle performing their pagan rituals on the Scottish coast.
Yes, that's... yes. Now it's time for your appointment, Ramirez, with the Wicker Man. Actually, that's a really good point about them being friends, because at the end of this sequence, they become something more. But we can talk about that as we get towards the end.
Rob, yeah, we're not talking about queer theory till the next episode.
Well, there's a little bit of... the reason I like this sequence, well, there are many reasons, but one of them is because it has a couple of nice callbacks that, rather than showing that Connor is just very good with a sword now, it shows that he has developed, and it's all done through the dialogue, and it's not signposted, but they're just really, really nice moments.
I really like how, yeah, when you've got kind of Ramirez puts his hand on Connor's arm and says, let yourself feel the stag. And like his breath is getting heavy and you can kind of feel him connecting to this creature. And then you've got a wonderful shot of his feet and one of Connor's feet is just pouring the sand.
Yes.
His blood. Coursing. Feel? Come on!
That's right, yeah. Which is, again, is just a nice touch from this actor who you think, well, again, that could be a bit silly, but he just sells it entirely.
And then you've got them because, you know, they take off and they're running along the beach, like, laughing like loons, which is just really lovely. And then you've got that shot from below, that tilt up, as they jump over the camera. Mm. And admittedly, I did freeze frame it to try and see if Lambert is a true Scotsman.
Well, that's very interesting there, because actually I am going to jump ahead a little bit. There's a shot in this particular sequence where they jump off of a cliff into the water. And you can see that the stunt double is wearing underwear. So at least the stunt double for Connor was not a Scotsman or a true Scotsman.
Lambert does also seem to be wearing undies in that shot.
Yeah, I had a look and thought, I think I'm not seeing things flapping around there. So and the reason for that, I wonder if he said, I don't mind doing it. And it would have been a case of, if the MPAA see that there's a cock and balls in this film, they're going to give it an X rating. So we're not going to have that.
It's also interesting that obviously there's this the idea of the profound empathy and connection to all living things that foreshadows the prize, that they never really, if it's like, if this is kind of a power, they never really use it. You know, it'd be amazing if there was like a kind of Snow White or even kind of Ace Ventura style moment in this where they call upon the forces of nature to, as their army.
Right, I see. Right.
You said previously how, you know, you're disappointed that the Kurgan doesn't have an army. Imagine the Kurgan with like an army of rats. He just summons up all the vermin out of the New York, out of the New York underground.
How amazing would that be? That would be great if he would. Yeah, that's a really good point. It's like, yes, you could summon up anything, right? It doesn't have to be people. And summoning up an army of rats would be, well, it would be quite astonishing. And there's a very good moment in the Werner Herzog, I think 1979 adaptation of Nosferatu, which is obviously the Dracula story. And so Dracula has come to town, but he's not just brought rats, he's brought madness. And there's this scene in which there's, I think it's like a party going on in the town square, but there are hundreds of rats everywhere. And there are people eating at this table with rats around their feet. And it's just this amazing moment of conveying pestilence and madness. And it's quite astonishing. And yeah, to have that, to have something like that in a fantasy film where it's an army that's been conjured up would be, yeah, that'd be great.
And then you could even maybe, imagine how great it would be, like Connor's sort of just walking through, I don't know, Times Square, walking through Manhattan somewhere, and amid the crowd, you just get a shot of the stag.
Yeah, yeah. It's well, Michael Mann was one for that, wasn't he? Like, there's that bit in Collateral where you just see the wolf at one point, yeah. And it's like, wow, why have subtext when you can have good old text?
You know, it's obviously happened to, you know, to me. You know, I live in semi-central London, and, you know, I see foxes all the time. And, you know, did try to feel the fox once, but... And now I have rabies, so...
Yeah. But you do also have a real weird desire to break into chicken coops as well and run off with the farmer's chickens.
And yeah, you know, it's been a real issue for people that need to, you know, transport me across a river, but they've also got a chicken and...
Yeah, indeed. They've got a bag of grain.
Space on the boat. Yeah, exactly.
Take the fox back with you. The fox goes across and then goes back again. So, yes, this is another example of, and again, we've talked about this before, but how did this film fail? Because we have the shot of the stunt doubles on the mountaintop. And that is just such an amazing shot. And because we saw this at the cinema about 4 or 5 years ago at the National Film Theatre on the South Bank on their big main screen. And I, even though it was really, really recent, I do not remember being impressed with that shot as much as I am when I watch it on my telly. And it's like, I really want to go back and watch this on a big screen again, just for that sort of shot, because it's such an amazing shot that even though you can see their stunt doubles, it just doesn't matter, because it's like, well, they are clearly for real on top of that sloping huge bit of rock with quite a drop around them. And it looks amazing. Which is, I think, was on the Isle of Skye, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It's the Keok Buttress. Sorry, I don't know why I put an accent on buttress rather than on Keok. The Keok Buttress on Saron Narsish in the Black Cullen Mountains on Skye.
Wow, okay. So we should try and get up there to do an episode.
Well, they've probably... The prop sword's still probably at the bottom of the mountain because there's no way they sent anybody to get that.
Well, that was the thing I was going to say. There's another bit of amazing potential for fan fiction here of Ramirez sending Connor down to get his sword, saying, yeah, well done, mate, you disarmed me, now go and get my sword. And Connor spending like a day and a night and a day having to look for this sword. I think that would be a good 12-page short story or something like that.
And it's got the lovely the shot where the kind of helicopter is pulling away and Michael Kamen's score is in full force. And Lambert, or, you know, Lambert's stunt double celebrates. You go, no, he puts his arms up and does, you know,
yeah, D, which is a really, really nice way, because that is a very, very Connor thing to do. He would be so happy with that moment. The first helicopter shot, when it goes round them fighting, is actually reverse, because it was too dangerous to fly it the other way. So basically what you see in that is two helicopter shots that were done in the same direction, but they reverse one so that it wasn't going the same way twice. And it's like, and again, you would never guess that their actions have been reversed. I mean, they're, yeah, just sword fighting, but it doesn't look like they've been reversed. It's really clever, that. It's like, oh, I just, again, I would just never guess that was reversed, but I would imagine something to do with the winds or something like that meant it was way too dangerous to go the other way.
I guess you didn't want to be flying it towards them. I guess maybe in both cases it has to be moving away from the mountain, because if you're flying towards the mountain, then if there's a gust of wind, you can hit the mountain.
I think it is going toward the mountain, but they couldn't shoot on the other side. It was
okay.
It was, which again, yeah, could be one of those things about how the wind was traveling around the mountain or something. Because you're kind of thinking, yeah, I can see why you'd have stunt doubles, because they are quite high up. They don't seem to be tethered to anything. They're just standing. It is, yeah, the bluff is quite big, but if you lost your footing, you could be in some dangerous. Like, yeah, there is that. There's also the fact that there's a helicopter going around them as well, and if there was an accident, then you might lose the leads of your film.
Rob, are you telling me that somebody took precautions while shooting with a helicopter? Because, you know...
Well, I think this would be the most safe time to shoot with a helicopter, because this would have been 3 years after The Twilight Zone.
The scene for a movie version of Twilight Zone attempted to recreate the terror and the carnage of the hell that was Vietnam. And then, as the crew watched in horror early this morning, the make-believe dissolved and actor Vic Morrow and two Vietnamese children were killed.
And so, yeah, I think anything... Can you just imagine the insurance claims for Hollywood movies at that point? If you got a helicopter shot in your film that was around people, they would have said, okay, right, and what are the safety precautions here? And how many hundreds of flying hours does this guy have? And has he worked on a film set before? And yeah.
If they'd killed Sean Connery, the whole crew wouldn't have made it out of Scotland alive.
No, that's right. They would have. Yeah, they wouldn't have done. Could you? Oh. So yes, that's the... So there are many, many reasons why this is stunt doubles. One of them being, how do you get up there? Because it does seem as if there's a walkway, but again, it seems very, very narrow with a sheer drop on either side. And he doesn't talk about it on... Because I was hoping the Russell Mulcahy would talk about it on the audio commentary, saying how they get up there. Like, yeah, were they dropped there from the helicopter, or did they have to climb up there? I mean, it's... I don't know.
Well... I can imagine they would have had to, you know, they would have wanted to drop the film crew up there. But if you really want to know, from the Kyle of La Clash, you cross over to the new bridge to Skye, then take the A850, which goes to Portree. Carry along this road until you reach Sligo Cairn, where you should turn left onto the A863. Continue along this road for 4 or 5 miles, then take the left turn onto the B809, which goes to Carbost. After a mile or so, take the narrow road on your left to Glen Brittle. After 8 to 10 miles, you will reach the end of the road. Follow the path down to the campsite, from where a path heads off into the Cullen Mountains. Follow the path for half a mile or so, where it splits into two. The path on the left goes into Quala Gan, from where you can look up to the location high above you. Ultimately, follow the path to the right, which goes up to the Nuxheesh, where after a 700-meter climb, you'll be able to look down onto the Keogh. Whichever path you follow, you should be prepared for the hills and definitely have a detailed map of the area.
I wonder how many Highlander fans have had to be rescued by helicopter.
That is on Scotland the Movie Location Guide.
Right, okay.
www.scotlandthemovie.com.
Well, that's some good info. Yeah, we have to try and get up there and do it.
This episode is definitely going to be used in the inquest after our deaths.
Yes, I was going to say, we will be on the news one way or another. Their bodies were later found next to a prop sword.
Oh, yeah, apparently when the sword went flying off the mountain, it wedged into a rock. Amazingly, when the two Robs both fell off the mountain together, they managed to impale themselves on the same blade.
Yes, one dropped on top of the other. I mean, there are freak accidents, and then there's, I think... The universe had decided that it just wanted rid of these people, because what are the odds of that happening?
Yeah, they'd said, feel the stag too self-satisfiedly too many times.
And a big gust of wind blew them away. But the Zoom mic they were using, not a scratch on it. Still in Rob's hand.
Still recording.
God, the battery life on that could be great.
The terrified screams they gave when they fell to their deaths are the best thing they ever recorded.
Yeah. No, it would be something even weird. It would just, oh my God, they actually said a quote from Highlander as they fell. So something like, Rob, I think I'm slipping. Of course you are. And then they both went.
There can be only,
There can be. they're loving it as much as we are. That's clearly going to happen.
To move quickly onto the next scene in this sequence, you've got Connery and Lambert back in the woods, finishing off the training sequence, with the camera tracking in low through the forest, over the leaves. It's a very kind of Sam Raimi Evil Dead shot, isn't it?
It is. I've got that in my notes. It's actually because it tracks along the ground, and it is, yeah, very much like the demon cam from the Evil Dead. It was actually done with a Lerma crane, which is a crane that has this remote control arm on it that the cameras, they're mounted to. And at the time that this film was made, not every film was using the Lurie McCrane because it was such a wonderful new bit of kit to get that sort of shot. And it was one of those things where so few films were actually using it that whenever the crane was used, it would have a plaque on it saying what films it had been used on. And he said for a while, the crane said Indiana Jones, Star Wars, a few others, and Highlander. But now they're like ten a penny, and there's also other models and stuff. So they're, yes, everyone is using them now. But at the time this film was made, it wasn't the norm to be using a Lurie McCrane. And so again, this film is, it had a healthy budget, but he did know how to use it to get the equipment to make this film look very visually lush and striking. And you kind of, you know, imagine that he might have been introduced to a Lurie McCrane, I don't know, on one of his music videos. Because again, it does seem to have, it is the Evil Dead, but also seems to have a touch of the music video to it as it goes along this rich, lush vegetation up to these two figures. And is there kind of a mist behind them or something? I mean, it's a beautifully composed shot.
And we also have perhaps one of the best lines in the film.
Which is?
Now, Pendejo, shall we see what sort of swordsman you've become?
Yes.
Just Sean Connery saying Pendejo. It's like,
it's brilliant, isn't it?
Now, Pendejo, shall we see what sort of swordsman you've become? On guard.
And again, I also like the fact that it's not a really big sword fight, because of course the better you become at something, the less you lunge and parry and things like that, because you're so good that it's like it actually isn't going to take that long to,
I mean, I've always found that applies to podcasting.
Yes.
I think we've
well, I've always found, yeah, that applies to the beautiful act of lovemaking as well.
Feel the stag. No, not like that.
Feel the stag. And again, just a couple of parries and I'm done. give me your hand, brother.
Give me your hand, brother.
Well, this moment's really nice because you've got, you know, again, they've got the kind of the parry back and forth. And Connor's still the kind of happy-go-lucky version of himself, but there's a focus to him there wasn't previously. There's just that glimpse of his future self.
Oh, this is, I love the end. I love that this is the way that they end the montage because, yeah, you're right, there is a focus. There's also a confidence there. And you can see in this, because we've talked before about why did Ramirez choose Connor? Why didn't he just, you know, try to get the prize himself? And so why does he cast himself as this mentor figure when he's got skin in the game as well? But in this scene, I think that Lambert really sells the idea that it's like, yes, with some training and with some guidance on how to tap into his potential, he has become the best of them. And again, as I said, it's only done, there's just like a few things where there's a lunge and a deflection or a block, but it's like, well, these, but Ramirez is great at this and Connor is blocking with a certain amount of ease, and you can see the progression of the character.
Very good.
And again, it's just done through action and it's done through Lambert's facial expressions. And then that wonderful bit when Connor has him at sword point and Ramirez looks really uneasy.
Uh-oh.
And then he says, give me your hand, brother, and helps him up. And it's like, that seems a really nice way to end this particular montage with him saying, because of course it begins with, we are brothers.
We are the same, McCloud. We are brothers.
And at the end he says, give me your hand, brother. It's like, what a great way to end this particular sequence.
So yeah, there's also, yeah, he kind of disarms Ramirez, you know, as you say, it's quite understated. It looks quite easily. And you've got that shot of the back of Ramirez's head, but just before Connor gives him a hand up. And that's another shot where it's clearly a pickup that's been done with the stunt double.
Yeah, yeah, there's some elements of that. It's also one of those things where it completely, at 49:22, it completely smashes the 180 degree rule. So the rule being that you stay on the same side of the line when you cut, so the audiences can keep a sense of the space. But Connery is on screen left for most of their fight, but when Connor pushes him over, Ramirez is suddenly falling screen right. And it's like, it doesn't matter, even though that is a huge break of one of the basic tenets of filmmaking to understand space. And I wonder why they did that. I also wonder why they didn't flip the shot and just hope that no one noticed that for a moment Connor was left-handed. It's, But yeah, it is weird that they broke the 180 degree rule there. But it's a nice, yeah, it's a nice thing, as I said. Like, yeah, the Ramirez says, we are brothers. And then it ends with giving you a hand, brother. It's all about the emotion. There's also like a nice element of this that goes back to the Karate Kid, which we talked about a few episodes ago, when Mr. Miyagi says to Daniel that he hates fighting, and Daniel says, but you love karate, so you love to fight. And he says, is that what you think? No. Then why are you training, Daniel? So I won't have to fight. It's like, yeah, there's just this element of that in 80s films with the mentor figure. And again, I think it does come from, as we talked about, it comes from those Eastern action movies where they would be talking in these very spiritual, cosmic, and pantheistic terms as well.
Yeah, and I do think that's a thread kind of running through this scene. The idea of oneness and connectedness and... Yeah, and I think pantheism, because the film, you know, is in this film, as we said in a recent episode, holy ground is a thing. You know, you can't fight on holy ground. And in Highlander, nobody ever fights on holy ground, so you never see the consequence of it. But in the wider canon, it's implied that there are, you know, like natural disasters that occur. So this is a film in which there is an idea of the divine, of the holy. And I think, it does tend to be put in kind of pantheistic terms. Mm-hmm. And it's all about empathy and kinship, which, you know, going back to the fact this is a film that most people know as the one where the Frenchman's doing a Scottish accent, it's people running around chopping each other's heads off, is actually a really nice kind of underlying ideology, might be a bit strong, but a moral to it.
Yeah, I think it just plays into its wider ideas, but doesn't. And I think also one of the reasons why it's really hooked onto people's imaginations is that it doesn't labour its points, so it puts scenes in there and then allows the audience's imagination to run with it, as we're doing now. It's again, for a film that, as we said before, is a film that didn't do very well when it came out, was kind of dismissed as another example of music video film directing. There's just so much in this film that makes it great.
Well, is there anything else we'd like to talk about in this scene?
No, I think we've covered it all. Like the stag, we shall have to run.
Well, in which case, I think that's a very good place to end it. Rob, if people would like to find you online, where can they do so?
If you want to find me on Twitter, you can at @Rob_A_Daniel. You can find my writing at electric-shadows.com, filmstories.co.uk, and lovehorror.co.uk at the moment. And if you want to hear Rob and myself talk about films in general, then you can at the Movie Robcast, which you can listen to wherever you're listening to this. And if you want to follow that podcast on Twitter, then you can at Movie Robcast.
Great. If you want to follow me online, you can find me on Twitter at Robert M. Wallace. You can also find my writing at Of All the Film Sites, www.ofallthefilmsites.com. If you'd like to follow Another Time McCloud, the pod to which you're currently listening, you can find that on Twitter at McCloud Time. You can also drop us an email at whowantstopodforever@gmail.com. And if you've enjoyed the podcast, or even if you haven't, if you'd like to, if you wouldn't mind rating and reviewing wherever you're listening to this, it really is very much appreciated.
And if you haven't enjoyed it, then please give some constructive criticism in your review as to what you think could be improved.
Yes, I say the internet. Well, it's the best place to ask for constructive criticism, I've found.
I find that some people who listen to podcasts have more of a constructive criticism than just a lot of the other people on the internet.
And whoever's listening to a Highlander podcast obviously has impeccable taste. So,
absolutely.
Well, Mr. Daniel, as always, thank you.
And thank you.
And thank you very much for listening. And I guess that all that's left to say is...
Lovely.